RCR with Paul Brennan.
To geopolitics in 2025 at RCR, and specifically, well, two things. First up, what happened over the weekend in the White House and the fallout since, and the Chinese naval activity in the Tasman Sea. Fast-moving geopolitical shifts affecting Australia and New Zealand right now. And joining us again is Ramesh Thakur, former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, Emeritus Professor in the Crawford School of Public Policy, the Australian National University, and a Brownstone Institute Senior Scholar, and a guest many times on RCR. And I think this is the first time we've chatted in this new year, Ramesh. So great to have you. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be back again. Thanks for having me again.
All right. Here's the first question, and we can unpack it to a certain extent in the time we've got.
You start with the new sheriff in town.
Okay. The new. Can we bring in the theme, like the Gunsmoke theme or something like that? You know, High Chaparral, I don't know what. But yeah, there's a new sheriff in town. And I think what we saw was possibly, seriously, history in the making, would you say?
Oh, unmaking. Look, Trump was elected with a mandate to be the disruptor in chief. Now, he engaged in more rapid fire disruption in the first 10 hours rather than first 100 days, and certainly in the first 10 days. And he's now moving on foreign policy. Not that he didn't before, but remember the threats of tariffs against Mexico and Canada, which got them to back down very quickly, and then other wild statements regarding Panama and Greenland. And you never know with Trump which part is serious and which part is just Trump being Trump, so to say. But there's no doubt that even in foreign policy, things that he is doing, he did promise during the election campaign, and he surrounded himself with top ministers and aides who reflect that worldview. And that's another thing that people should spend some time teasing out and unpacking. And that is, he's learned from his point of view, mistakes he made in the first term when he was elected president. He was not a politician. He really didn't know what to expect. He has said, I think, a few times that he came into the White House very naive. He'd been elected president. He was commander-in-chief. He was decider-in-chief. Well, as we know in New Zealand and Australia, governments propose, bureaucracies dispose. The administrative state, about which we've talked in the past, is clearly deeply entrenched. And that extends to the foreign policy establishment. Let's remember, Trump was the first president in a long time not to begin a new war on his watch. It's not that he's not prepared to use force. He did a few times. But that when he says something, the opponents and potential rivals do take him seriously, and he's very volatile, and he's forceful. So there's all that. And for Ukraine, this is no longer 2022. It's 2025. Second, Ukraine as a country and Zelensky as president both have a history with Trump. And we know he carries grudges for a long time. And Ukraine was the pretext on which the entire Russia collusion hoax pretty much destroyed his agenda in the first term. And Zelensky didn't act on Trump's request to investigate links between Hunter and Joe Biden and Burisma and corruption in Ukraine. And that link by Trump has stood the test of time a lot better than allegations of Russia collusion hoax and Trump being a Putin stooge. And he has said in a number of long-form interviews, even since being elected, that Putin knows that Trump can be the toughest guy going. And if Putin tries to pull a fast one, Trump will respond accordingly. And that's the basis for his claims that he's not going to disrespect me. So those things are there. And I think rather than what happened in the Oval Office, you have much better ideas of what they have in mind in several statements from high-ranking officials around Trump, as well as Trump himself. And what they've said is, effectively, for 3 years, you've carried on a war that's brutal, and he's walked back his off-the-cuff false claims about Ukraine having started the war. But what they have said is, you need not have got into the war. You need to get out of it. And you went into it without a strategy for peace, without a strategy for victory, and not even an exit strategy if you get caught in a grinding stalemate that's hurting both sides. And then he makes a point, and he made that angrily to Zelensky in the dust-up, or bust-up, whichever you prefer, when he said, look, don't call me or imply I'm a Putin stooge. I'm the guy in the middle. And as the guy in the middle, you can't have me wag my finger and say naughty, naughty to Putin and then say, by the way, Vlad, how are we doing in the deal? That's not how it works. And that is something we know as academics from the conflict resolution literature. If you want to be a neutral mediator, you don't start condemning any party, even privately, let alone publicly. Otherwise, you lose your ability to act as a mediator. And I think the statement by Rubio that, you know, saying let's wait another year until thousands more have died and then reassess, that's not a strategy. And Trump was very explicit, and he clearly means it, that you're fighting a vicious war. You're risking a terrible World War III. And where is the realistic calculation that you're going to do any better? And if we pull out, you're going to have to fight it out. You think you'd do any better? So all those things were there, and they just built up. And I think my individual position is, I think Zelensky has a lot of the adulation in the Western world has gone to his head. And the NATO on this issue parted company with the rest of the world, and the majority of the world. And we've seen this in public opinion polls from the West. The majority of countries in the world, at least governments and people, believe that Russia was provoked by the NATO expansion. The major Western media before February 2022 depicted Ukraine as not maybe a dictator, but very heavily qualified democracy. The 2014 incidents were a coup against the democratically elected president, because he was pro-Russian, and there was heavy American involvement. Then the third of Russians-oriented population of Ukraine, Russian-speaking and identifying with Russia. If Canada was to treat the French Canadians like that, we would all be horrified. That's not how a democracy behaves. There's only half that, less than half that proportionately Muslims in India. If Modi was to treat the Muslims like that, we would be horrified, and I would be horrified and not be agitating against it. So there's all those background factors and complexities, and all Trump is saying is, we want a deal. You want a security guarantee. We're not going to do that. But in practice, this rare earths mining corridor in Eastern Europe, if it's jointly funded by Ukraine and the US, and perhaps even if the Europeans were to join in, then for practical purposes, you have a functioning commercial tripwire, and Putin will know better than to cross that.
Isn't that so obvious?
Well, then why this reaction? I mean, I don't know New Zealand, what New Zealand has said. From what I've seen, I think the New Zealand Prime Minister has also sided with Ukraine. The Europeans have sided with Ukraine. On our side of the Tasman, both the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition have sided very publicly with Zelensky on this. And my reaction is, can you please not look at the world through European eyes and assess the United States and what's happening through Australian eyes? That is a country located southeast of the Asian mainland. Our biggest strategic threat is China. We've had statements from J.D. Vance in the past. We've had statement from the nominee for Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Elbridge Colby, very explicitly saying, we are no longer in a position where the United States can carry the security burden in every part of the world. Europe in total has more wealth, is richer, and has a greater population than the United States. They are able to look after Europe if they want to. Why should the American taxpayers subsidize net zero and DEI and gender identity and open borders and mass immigration as luxury belief by the Europeans while we look after the defense? Let them look after that defense. We want to refocus on and prioritize the China threat in the Pacific. It seems to me, to an Australian, that is a very sensible position to take. And if you come back to the events on the weekend and before that, the deal that the Cook Islands has signed with China, it's a timely reminder that we face our own threats and we should think before just identifying so openly with Zelensky against a president who remembers these grudges.
Well, that's an important consideration, isn't it? Because given what you've said about Trump's personality, it won't go unnoticed that countries like Australia and New Zealand and their leaders are lining up on a particular side, let me put it that way, that doesn't escape attention. How can that be good for us?
It isn't. I think we're still living in the Cold War mentality where we think the United States can guarantee security against everyone. I mean, look, China is now the biggest naval fleet in the world. And it has a capacity to acquire new modern warships at a rate that is phenomenal. It's gone from about 255 to 400 ship navy in a decade. I just had an article published today in The Spectator where I make the point that in Australia, it takes us a decade to decide whether they need to set up a new committee, establish the terms of reference for the committee and choose the people. And by the time the committee starts meeting, a new government comes in and overturns that original decision. And so we go on and on and on. Our earliest new submarines, if they come about, will be in the late 30s or 40s. China will have double, trebled its navy by then at this rate. So it all fits in. And I'm hoping that it will refocus and concentrate our minds. But at the moment, I mean, I wrote my article partly in frustration that things that look so obvious to me seem to have escaped the notice of people. You know, we keep telling new immigrants, leave your original country's conflicts behind, become Australian first. And of course, you can retain ties, emotional ties and sentimental ties and family connections, but think as Australians. Well, that applies just as much to the original settlers from Europe and from the UK. Fine, retain the cultural ties, but in terms of strategic self-interest, remember Thucydides, remember Lord Palmerston. Thucydides, questions of, and he was very blunt in his history of the Peloponnesian Wars. Questions of right and justice do not apply or apply only in relations among equals. For others, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. And Lord Palmerston, countries, especially great powers, have no eternal allies, no perpetual enemies. What they have is eternal and perpetual interests. It forges new relationships. And again, I forget whether it was Trump or Vance or one of the top people made the point that the geopolitical landscape has shifted even since my first term. And we need to realign our priorities and therefore our policies to the new reality. And, you know, the parting message, well, I think Trump said it even during the explosion, but then afterwards he has said it and others have repeated it. When you are ready to make peace, come back. Mm. And others have also said, if you are not ready to make peace, whether for personal motivations or for whatever political motivations, then maybe you should resign, and someone who's prepared to do a deal can come back to Washington and sign the deal. So I think all those factors are there, and they're playing out in real time, and we are just watching gobsmacked.
Yeah, like we were in the room. We kind of were. Get on to China in this part of the world in just a moment. That piece that you were mentioning just before in The Spectator, you say here, referring to Europe, I guess, their shock at the implosion in the Oval Office last week is more an indictment of their impuissance. They got no power, have they?
They've neglected it. They have the capacity to get power, but they've neglected it.
Well, they can't get it quick enough right now, can they?
Well,
against Russia.
They would need to act with the same speed and decisiveness as Trump in Washington.
Yeah.
Then
they're not
they
used
can.
To that. They're not used to that.
You know, the net zero fallacy is unraveling. The DEI agenda is unraveling. I think they are desperately searching for ways to end mass immigration, and the spate of serial murders in Germany is producing a backlash there against this liberal conceit that you can bring in a million people from radical conflict-prone environment and they suddenly become perfect Democrats. That doesn't wash. So it's not that people want to end immigration or treat all immigrants badly, but we need to look at the compatibility of new people with our values and not turn Australia or New Zealand or Germany into a hotel of convenience while they import their hatreds and rivalries and prejudices and stereotypes, etc., into our midst.
But they have no leverage with Russia, do they? Europe, really?
Well, that throws up a broader question. Can you imagine Europe being at peace as a stable continent without in some form incorporating Russia as a partner in the new security architecture? I don't think it's possible. I think they need both Russia and the United States as active participants, as stakeholders. That was a fundamental choice they faced at the end of the Cold War. There was a brief moment when it looked like the United States had decided for an all-inclusive security architecture in which no one was potentially on the outer and Russia would be an important partner. When that was first mentioned to Boris Yeltsin, I don't know if you've seen those. I forget who the American Secretary of State was, whether it was Baker or...
Baker, I think it was.
I think it was. Anyway, Yeltsin was surprised and he said, "Excuse me, Mr. Secretary, I'd like you to repeat that so I understand it clearly. You are saying it's going to be an inclusive partnership for peace where we will be at the table alongside others as well." And the answer was yes. And he said, "That is brilliant. That is perfect. We are very happy. We will go along with that." And then just a few months later, Clinton said, "No, we are going back on that. And we're going to go for NATO expansion instead." Well, NATO expansion meant it was on its original mission of Soviet containment, except it was NATO that was expanding and not Russia that was expanding. So that question, well, let me put it this way. If you want to engage in hardball diplomacy, which Trump did on Friday in the Oval Office, you had better make sure, firstly, that you have understood the power equations right and that you have the capacity to prevail. Or conversely, if you play hardball and you lose, please, whatever else you do, don't cry. You played
like
and lost.
Like the German guy, the EU.
Yeah. Oh, that was embarrassing.
The Munich thing. Yeah.
That was embarrassing. And he got a standing ovation. Yeah. Anyway, that's their business. So I think the point of that is the way they treated Russia would have made sense if, in fact, Russia had been completely defeated and demolished as a great power. Otherwise, you go to Henry Kissinger's bon mot. A great power doesn't retreat forever. Now, there's a point to Putin's claim that the end of the Cold War was the greatest geopolitical disaster for Russia, not for Soviet Union, not as an ideological disaster, a great power, realpolitik disaster. And so he's been busy reconstituting Russia with much diminished territory, much diminished population, and heavily reduced wealth. But he has popularity within Russia because, to a greater extent than not, he has succeeded. And once they believe that they are in a position to resist this creeping NATO expansionism and reducing room for maneuver for Russia, they took a stand. There is no basis on which we can say they did not tell us. They
No.
warned us repeatedly. So even now, it comes back to the same thing. Do we believe Russia is still a great power? If yes, then we either return to Cold War hostility and cut off contacts between Russia and the rest, or we say no for the sake of a joint future, and there is no other future. For peace and stability in the continent, we need to bring them in, we need to accommodate them with regard to their legitimate grievances. And you
And
look at what
that's what Trump's doing right now, and
that's what
that
he's
seems
doing,
to,
and it's necessary.
you've got to rebuild a relationship first before anything else, to a certain level, before
Yeah.
anything else can come about. That's the foundation of it. It seems like many people are missing that point.
Yeah. And I keep saying that if you think that what Putin did was wrong, then logically you also have to say that the way the Americans handled the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 was wrong. It was two sovereign states signing a defense pact and stationing the missiles of one in the territory of the other. If your sovereignty works for Ukraine, then it should have worked for them. But that's not how great powers behave, in their, especially in their immediate neighborhood. And unlike the United States, that part of the world has been the historical gateway for European invaders from mainland Europe to cross and inflict devastating destruction on Russia. So,
Well, Lavrov said, I think yesterday, relative to when we're speaking now, that they've been doing it for the last 500 years to us. He came right out and said it. So that's how close to the surface all that is.
It's a neuralgic sentiment. And William Burns, when he was ambassador in Moscow, and he's now CIA director, or sorry, he was
Excellent.
CIA director under Biden, he sent cables that WikiLeaks, I think, or published, where he reported, this is not a party political or this is not a personal issue. Every senior Russian subscribes to this neuralgic opposition to Ukraine joining NATO. And if they just rule that out, as Hegseth has now said, it's unrealistic, not going to happen. It's impossible today, unrealistic tomorrow, and unlikely in the unforeseeable future.
I'm just thinking of time here, conscious of time. So, what took place in the Tasman Sea with the Chinese naval vessels live firing? And I believe we found that out from the pilot of a Jetstar flight, not our P-8
Virgin,
Poseidon.
Virgin, Virgin,
Or
Virgin.
was it Virgin? Okay,
Yeah.
well, low-cost
Well,
carrier, let's put it that way.
let's start with some basic facts on that one.
Yeah.
As I said, China's fleet has expanded, almost doubled over the past decade. Against their 400 ship navy, Australia has a grand total of 16 ships.
Okay.
That includes six aging Collins class submarines. I don't know how many of them are on active duty or operational, and how many of them are effectively mothballed, but certainly not operational. And that leaves 10 surface combatants, of which seven are the famous Anzac class frigates and three destroyers. Now, you'll need to speak to a naval officer to get an authoritative statement, but my understanding of the hierarchy of naval ships is you have corvettes, which are the lightest and essentially do coastal patrol duty. Then you have frigates, which are larger and better armed, but not as well armed as destroyers. And mainly they do defensive escort duty, sort of operations. And it's destroyers that you really get to offensive capabilities as well as defensive. And then you have cruisers. Now, we are not in the game with cruisers. We have 7 frigates, which are aging as well. We, I think, is generally acknowledged in Australia now, have just about the oldest and smallest fleet in our history. This is for a country that has extensive maritime zone of strategic vulnerability. And we have relied on the United States to look after our security for understandable reasons, and that's fine. But that's history. Now, China historically has been a continental power, not a maritime power, not a blue water navy power, hasn't projected power, but is now becoming a modern comprehensive power with trade links that span the world. And it has long conveyed an interest in building a blue water navy with offshore power protection capability, with the need to safeguard its vital sea lanes of communication. Power protection, either to engage in area denial to potentially hostile ships in your claimed zone of interest, or as an assertion at sea of your power. That is something that great powers do. This is the first time China is doing something like this. Of its build-up, I think 8 of these destroyers were done, or 6 of the destroyers were built in the last 8 years, and they're now into phase 2 and going to double that as well. So that's, relativity is going very much in China's favor. Even the United States doesn't at the moment have the capacity to reverse that relative speed with which China is modernizing and expanding its navy. They want to, but that's why they need to, I think, shift focus and prioritize the Pacific over Europe. So that's a fact of life. So what then are the messages that China is sending by deploying, to begin with, 500 kilometers offshore, and then I think in the case of the Tasmania, it was as close as 150 kilometers, and engaging in live fire exercises. We, meaning the Allies, do this in contested regions in the South China Sea as well. So it's not as though they're doing something we do as well. But first and most importantly, the message is the Chinese military will sail and fly anywhere it chooses to. It will be limited by its operational capability, not by considerations of historical presence and discomfort on the part of those at the receiving end. Second, it is prepared to fire long-range weapons, gather intelligence, assert its presence whenever and wherever it wants. Leading this flotilla was a destroyer. I believe we now believe in Australia that its armaments included 2,000 kilometer range land attack missiles and 1,000 kilometer range ballistic anti-ship missiles as well. And we haven't got the capability to defend against that. Third, if they engage in live fire drill, we have no capability to resist. We have to bow down and accept that fact. And that means that we close the routes to air travel, air traffic and sea traffic, and wait until the exercise is over. Now, I'm assuming there's a deliberate diplomatic message alongside that, that they didn't go through proper authorities and give the advance notification. And our Prime Minister has, if you want to be polite, dissembled on that. He said, we learned at about the same time, I think his phrasing was, as a Virgin flight, which picked up on a communication, a general communication by the Chinese that they're going to conduct this exercise and passed it on. And then I think the New Zealand ship that was there, we got the message 90 minutes later, not at about the same time.
That's not good enough, is it?
No,
We've
it
got all
isn't.
this gear,
It
we've got
isn't.
these planes and
Yeah.
everything. It's cost the
It's risking an
taxpayer
accident.
billions.
It's risking an accident. It's risking lots of lives. But then they've been firing flares at our planes that go on surveillance duty in their contest, in their claimed region as well. So I think the message is, despite this boast from Albanese and Foreign Minister Penny Wong that we have stabilized the relationship with China, that is not a concept that exists in China's diplomatic vocabulary.
Right.
We do have to remember China's historical, literary, philosophical tradition is not acting as a great power in a system of great powers. It is a middle kingdom exacting and expecting tributes from the lesser vassal states around it. So it's
Okay.
sending that very clear, not subtle message. We know your place. We hope you know your place. And if we both know where we stand relative to each other, not a problem.
Well,
Next.
there's no choice but to only accept that because.
No, I don't think it's either or. If we had the capability, we could have gone into their face as well. Let me
If we had the capability.
if they had, think of it this way. Think of the way Greenpeace flotillas have harried and harassed Japanese whaling efforts in the open seas. They've just gone around them, made it known that they're there watching, they're filming. We could have had their RTV cameras mounted. We could have given video footage for the world media
Well, I get
just
back
to
to what I just
embarrass
said.
China.
What I
We
said
didn't.
before is we've got all this expensive gear.
Yeah.
Like the maritime planes cost 1.2 billion. They've got classified detection systems on them. And what are they sitting at an airbase somewhere?
Paul, let me put it even more crudely. Do you know? I mean, I've talked about our Navy. The rest of our military assets are not that much bigger or better in terms of our size, the armaments, the quality of our combat worthiness against major, etc. Do you know how much our Chief of Defense Force is paid compared to the American Chief of Defense Force?
I'm sure there's a. Well,
Four
no,
times
no,
as
tell me.
much.
I might be
Four times
surprised.
as much.
Right. Okay.
Think of the responsibility that the American Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has. Think of the destructive power at the command of the Pacific Commander, just one component of the American Navy. Our Chief of Defense Force is paid four times the amount that his American counterpart is paid.
How can that be so?
Our priorities are different.
Sounds like money laundering to me in a
Yeah.
way.
I'm sure our officers are much more sophisticated at the correct pronouns than the Chinese
Oh,
counterparts.
yeah, okay, I see. Okay, but if we're not keeping an eye out and we're relying on commercial airliners from low-cost carriers to do our intel gathering, it seems like we're.
We are living in a world of fantasy and delusions.
Wow. What about the timing of that visit? Because we had the Cook Islands situation that's
You have
been
the Cook
this year,
Islands situation, but the timing.
and that looked like our foreign affairs were kind of caught napping in a way. They're the way it played out anyway. Maybe they weren't, but it's
Well,
our
yeah,
view.
I can't comment. I don't know enough about
No,
that.
I know, but
But
it sort
certainly
of.
the impression is that both New Zealand and Australia were blindsided by that agreement.
Yeah,
Not agreement, agreements in plural, yeah.
there's also the relationship they have with Russia.
Yeah.
And who's falling on what side of the Ukraine conflict at this point? Is it all one big
Why
blancmange
do
of a whole
we?
lot of things, or is there thinking behind the timing of that from the Chinese
Well,
as well?
let's put it again, go back to the Ukraine conflict. By ganging up on Russia the way all the Western countries did, and by putting it under sanctions, and then by giving increasing military assistance to Ukraine in a bizarre strategy where we gave them enough assistance that they could keep on fighting, but not enough that they could win at the risk of a
Exhaust
nuclear
themselves,
war,
basically. They exhausted themselves. Yeah.
nor withholding so that they were forced to come to the negotiating table. The result of that was Putin and Xi Jinping entering into their famous No Limits Partnership. So the great singular achievement of the Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger era to detach China from the Soviet Union as a way of completely upending the Cold War dynamics has been reversed, and we made Russia and China co-dependent on each other in order to confront the West and pursue the long-held policy of reducing, if not ending, the dominance of the Western powers over the international system. Now, in that context, the preoccupation with Ukraine, we need to acknowledge that things are interconnected and that it is not in our interest to pick a fight needlessly with Russia. And it is much more in our strategic interest to drive a wedge between Beijing and Moscow. And the preoccupation meant that China gets a wonderful opportunity. They know we have no capability to resist or to do anything against the task force. So for them, the more interesting question, the more critical question would have been, if we do this, let's see how America responds. Two further things on that. One, China has a long diplomatic tradition by now. They don't pick fights that they know they're going to lose. And if they were to pick a fight openly with the United States, if they were to do something that they've done here between, say, Cuba and Florida, 150 kilometers off Florida's mainland, they know the reaction will be a bit different from what Australia can do. But a good way for them to test America's global resolve is to pick allies. Start with the weakest and the smallest link in the chain.
Yeah.
And then move up. So we'll test New Zealand first, see how far they are prepared to accommodate us rather than speak out. And we know that New Zealand didn't follow Australia in some robust responses to earlier provocations. And now they're coming after Australia, especially with a prime minister and a foreign minister for whom I suspect they have nothing but contempt. But I can't read their minds, so I don't know. But they certainly don't respect weakness, and that we do know. So I think it's probably in the diplomatic side aimed more at the United States than at Australia. And we'll have to wait and see. I don't think we command great attention span in Washington. At the time that all this is happening in Europe, I don't think we would get a hearing if you were to take our complaints to them. Had the relationship been different, we might have had. If we had an ambassador or foreign minister who has access to influential people in Washington, it might be different.
Right.
I think Rudd was a brilliant choice for the previous administration.
Yeah.
But if you're exceptionally good for one administration, if the regime changes...
Yeah, watch out. Be ready.
Well, not watch out. I think you need to adjust accordingly.
Well, that means changing the person and the personnel.
Either you have a professional diplomat who maintains links on all sides, or you have a political appointee who has links to one side. And then if that changes, you adjust accordingly.
But appointing people who have said not nice things about people who could come back on the scene, let's say, even just to mouth off like that isn't very smart, is it?
To be fair to Kevin, he said that when he was out of politics and he was out of diplomacy. He was seeing them as a private citizen. The mistake he made was, soon as he was appointed ambassador, he should have scrubbed those from his profile. Right. He didn't. That I think was a mistake. And on the other hand, if he can reinvent himself.
Yeah, sorry.
That would be a good start. But he does have things to offer to the Trump administration that very few other Australians would.
Okay.
And that is the detailed depth of his knowledge of China.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Okay. He, with his linguistic skills and his contacts, can offer a read on China and on Xi Jinping that very few other Australians would be able to do. And one advantage of having a transactional president and a transactional administration on all senior posts is that you can make that argument and make them forget the past history and say, you know, it's not that we want to, but it's actually in your interest to have me here. Why don't we put aside whatever ill-judged remarks I may have made, and I wasn't the only one, but like others. And look, the best way to flatter Trump at the moment is to begin the conversation by saying, wow, that was the greatest political comeback in American history, maybe in world history, and then take it from there.
Well, to be fair, and I'm not, don't get anyone get me wrong, I'm not a Trump fanboy, but to be fair, he's reestablished relationships which were quite damaged along the way as well. I think him and J.D. Vance at some point years ago were not seeing eye to eye. And I think Rubio, he was little Rubio. You remember that?
I remember all of that.
And all that sort of like evaporated away in the real politic moment of now.
Well, I think it's broader than that, Paul. I think it goes to why he wasn't just re-elected, but he won an increased majority for the party in Senate, managed to hold on to the House. And for the first time, he actually had more votes. The previous time he won with, what was it, 4 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton? This time he actually had more votes as well. And I think you need to go back to two things. Firstly, his detractors are unable to get past his vulgarity and his crudeness and his rhetoric to actually examine objectively his policies and achievements and failures. They take his words literally. They don't take his actions as president seriously. His admirers reverse that. They don't take his words literally. They don't even take the words seriously. But they take him and his actions seriously. And if you look at J.D. Vance, and especially if you read Hillbilly Elegy, he was a Democratic supporter at the time. But that whole book is much closer to the Trump philosophy of life than it is to the Democrats' DEI, did not earn it, philosophy. And I think the same is true of Rubio. So I don't think these two were examples of fawning to power as opposed to genuine philosophical conversions. Once they got beyond their psychological hurdles of Trump the man to look at Trump the candidate and the president. And I'm sure in the case of Vance, actually not just sure, we've had the statements from him and from his wife, Usha, after the Butler shooting assassination attempt on Trump, the admiration for Trump, the first instinctive response to get up and fight rather than to be a coward and surrender. And his ability to fight against the odds, I think that has won him many admirers. If you look at the polls at the time of the election, the exit polls, and then since then, what do people most admire about Trump? The fact that he says what he means. He doesn't care what anyone else thinks of what he's saying. He does what he says. And he's not afraid to take on the entrenched interests.
Isn't that why what happened in the Oval Office, why it's so, well, I'm just thinking of the word, incredible, because we actually saw what actually happens, really, I suppose, behind closed doors without any doubt, without any, you know, window dressing, anything. It was the real thing. There's something
it was,
quite...
And it's worth watching it over an extended period. Because you can see Trump visibly getting more and more agitated. And he's trying to hold himself in. You know, the most telling image from that entire encounter is not Trump, it's not Zelensky, it's not
the
Vance,
ambassador.
It's the ambassador.
Yeah.
Where she holds her face in her hands.
Yeah.
Clearly, Zelensky lost it.
We're right up against time. Just to sum up, back to our area
China
of the
factor.
World, what do we do? Because now here our politicians are talking about increasing defense spending to a certain level of GDP. Well, that's easy to say. What does that actually mean? And our GDP is not very much. So that probably doesn't result in much hardware. Anything that's going to be produced has got years that has to ramp in before we even get the physical item. Really, how to handle this if you're Australia?
Even before that, I'll tell you what I think is most urgently needed. Get together a very small group of people who understand the world as it really is, who have some knowledge and experience of world affairs. Bring them together from the outside in a small meeting. Have the insiders at the table as well. But have brainstorming sessions with contrarians and disruptors in the room. Say, okay, what is the new world in which we find ourselves? And how should we engage with that? What are our interests? What are our values? There's just too much of legacy thinking and policy in Australia and New Zealand at a time when the world is experiencing rapid flux to our increasing disadvantage. We have got captured by so many competing interests and lobby groups that we seem to have lost the capacity to engage in deep reflection on what is the vision for a world in which we want to live in? What are our assets for shaping, however modestly, or bend the arc of history to our preferred destinations? And what's the best strategy for getting there? And you know, bureaucracies invariably become captive to groupthink. That's why you need to bring in outsiders. Not outsiders who are contrarians for the sake of contrarians, whose commitment to your country's best interests you have to take for granted based on what they've said and done in the past. But bring them in, force an open concentration with the status quo people in the room, and then take it from there. And I think I would like to see much greater use made of people with experience and expertise from outside the establishment bureaucracies.
Yeah, it's the same old, same old.
Yeah, and then they prefer incrementalism and reform. Well, it's a transformational inflection point in world order.
That's well put.
And we need to accept that and respond accordingly. Do we have the intellectual followed by the policy, nimbleness and agility? If not, we are going to continue to live in very interesting times.
Let's leave it there. As always, fascinating chatting with you. Thanks for coming back on now on RCR, Ramesh.
It's been a pleasure.
And there'll be more. There'll be more. And
the year is young yet
for the next bit. All right. All the best.
Take care,
Thank
Paul.
You.